When we left off last time, we had come to, you know, the center of the book of Leviticus. We looked at the Day of Atonement, which we saw is the middle speech in Leviticus. And it's you know, the clear, the clear chiastic center of the book. After it's finished, I said we might come back and look at it in more detail to talk more about the theology, but after I thought about it for a while, I decided to just go ahead and move on with the second half of Leviticus. I don't know how long people's patience can deal with Leviticus. We'll see. We still have a little ways to go, though. We could be here forever, but we're trying to get a pretty good general overview of the book. So I decided to move on to the second half of the book, which you can see in your notes there represents a change, a shift from that, from the chiastic center of the Day of Atonement. Chapters 17 to 27 collectively are oftentimes referred to as the Holiness Code. Because they definitely represent a change in the book and its emphasis. What we saw in particular in the first half of the book is a focus on drawing near to God. You have, in the first seven chapters, you have the various offerings listed which allow, the worshiper to, you know, renew covenant with God and to draw near. We have legislation for the priest, who are the mediators between the worshiper and God. And then we have the legislation for the clean-unclean distinctions, which tells us who may or may not approach a holy God. So the first, you know, and all that, of course, culminates in the Day of Atonement, which is, you know, the Sabbath of Sabbaths, the high holy day of the year that allows the priest to go behind the veil into the most holy place itself. So in summary, the first half of the book really focuses on what we call cultic legislation. In other words, having to do particularly with the worship of God. When you come to chapter 17 to 27, the shift is related, as we're going to see today, to worship legislation. But it has more to do with life in the kingdom. Okay, in other words, it kind of has a little more to do with the other 6 days of the week. All right, so there's a marked shift that takes place. What I want to do today is kind of just sort of generally introduce us to 17 to 27. And in particular, the next section, which is chapters 17 through 20. All right, which are, you know, kind of the intro to this second portion of Leviticus. To understand Leviticus, to understand this second portion, we need to keep in mind the setting of the book and what we've studied thus far. And remember, the book of Leviticus is given at Mount Sinai. God has redeemed Israel from Egypt. He's brought the nation to Mount Sinai. God comes down, you know, on the holy mountain. And the holy mountain becomes like a new Garden of Eden. It's going to be a type even of the tabernacle itself. The Israelites can't touch the mountain. It's holy. Only the elders can go up part of the way. And then the top of the mountain is like the most holy place. Only Moses can go there and draw near to God who comes down on the top of the mountain. Now, it's there that God gives to Moses the legislation for the tabernacle, which takes up the bulk of, you know, the second portion of Exodus. And then he gives this legislation in Leviticus, which of course is all, you know, it's related to the tabernacle and the fact that God is going to now dwell in the midst of Israel. In other words, they're going to take the mountain with them when they leave. Okay? Now, and so we have to keep that in mind and remember that God enters into covenant here with the nation of Israel. And they become his treasured possession they become a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And they're made holy by God's presence. Okay? By the fact that God is going to dwell with them in their midst now in the tabernacle. You remember, after the golden calf incident, God's going to destroy the nation, and Moses pleads with him, so God says, okay, I won't destroy him, but I'm not going to go with you. And Moses is, you know, like, if your presence doesn't dwell in us, you might as well, you know, go ahead and kill us here. It's meaningless unless God dwells in the midst of Israel. And so God relents, and he renews the covenant with the nation. All right? And so that first, so everything in Leviticus, you know, is tied up with these events. And so that first portion of the book is all about now how can we approach this holy God who's going to dwell in our midst. And then the second portion of the book concerns more how do we live now as God's holy nation in such a way that the goal of Israel's election would be realized. Okay? What do we mean? Well, let's think about Leviticus in terms of redemptive history. In the beginning, God, you know, he creates these various environments. He creates the world, and within the world is the land of Eden. Within the land of Eden is the Garden of Eden. God places Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. God gives to Adam a priestly task. He's told to guard the garden. He's told to work in the garden. Later on now, when the priests are given their job, they're told the exact same thing in regard to the tabernacle. Okay? They're to work in it, and they are to guard it. And the exact same two words in Hebrew are used in regard to the priest task. And that's the only other place where they are come together in the Hebrew text. And so it's very clear that the Garden of Eden is the sanctuary. It's the place where the sacraments are. It's the place where God meets man. So most theologians believe that Adam's job to guard and work in the garden is his priestly task. You know, God made us kings and prophets and priests, okay? But in addition to that priestly task, Adam and Eve are given a kingly task, which is to go forth from the garden and to subdue the earth for the glory of God, to have dominion over everything. And we can surmise that since there's a river that flows out of Eden and it parts to four heads to water the four corners of the earth, that Adam and Eve would have gone downstream following and their descendants, because they're going to multiply. They're not going to have dominion over the earth by themselves. They're going to have children, and their children will have children. And they will populate the earth, and mankind will have dominion over the earth and transform the earth for the glory of God. Just as God transformed it each day, making it better so that by the end of the week it's all very good. Okay? Well, man sins, and because of man's sin, that task got off tracks. Now, God starts over with Noah. He covers the world back up, makes it formless and void again. He baptizes it, etc. And then he starts over with Noah, and, you know, the ark lands on a mountain. He tells him, now you be fruitful and multiply. Okay? Well, we know that plan goes south as well. Every time we get our hopes up in the old covenant, that happens. Okay? As Genesis unfolds, you get this creation, redemption kind of theme going on again at the end of the book with Joseph. Joseph is a premier type of Christ in the Bible. Joseph is betrayed by his brothers. He's symbolically killed. He's thrown in a pit. You know, he descends into the abyss. He's put in jail where he's surrounded by two criminals, you know, a baker and a cupbearer of all, you know, bread and wine, obviously. And one is restored, the other isn't, just like Jesus and the two criminals beside him on the cross. And Joseph goes from this place of humiliation to a place of exaltation at the right hand of Pharaoh. And at the end of Genesis, Joseph saves the whole world. His brothers all come up to, and they're given the land of Goshen, which Genesis 13 compares to the garden of the Lord. And Exodus opens up and it says they're fruitful and they multiplied. Okay? Paradise restored. okay? Or postmillennialism at the end of Genesis, right? Well, then we got another fall, okay? Now a Pharaoh emerges that doesn't know Joseph. Well, why does he emerge? Well, we're not told in Exodus 1, but later on, Joshua tells us that the children of Israel worshiped the gods of Egypt while they were there. He says, choose for yourself this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your father served, in the land of Egypt, etc. Okay? The reason things went bad in Egypt was because Israel started worshiping the gods of Egypt. Ezekiel says the same thing too. Okay? All right, and so you got this creation fall redemption thing going on, this new Garden of Eden stuff. Well, God now takes Israel. He delivers Israel from Egypt. He brings them to his holy mountain, and he enters into covenant with them. He gives them this tabernacle, which, you know, faces eastward, like the garden has the cherubim embroidered on the veil, etc. So it's like paradise is restored again. Okay? And that happens lots and lots of times in the Bible. Okay? So we saw all of that. We saw all that, how the early legislation in Leviticus is all about granting man access to God again for the first time in a very long time. And the first time we see anybody having a meal with God is when the elders go up on Mount Sinai, part of the way up, and have a meal with God. The patriarchs, they offer ascension offerings, but they don't do peace offerings. They don't get to have a meal with God. But the tabernacle is going to make that possible through the offerings and so on. All right? So, if Israel is God's new son, then we should expect a new commission for the world. All right? In Israel, you think about it, out of Israel, I've called my son. Okay? Israel becomes God's adopted son at the Passover. And Adam was God's first earthly son. Okay, so Israel's a new Adam. I mean, it's like the high priest is specifically the new Adam. But Israel, to a lesser extent, is like new Adam. The commission given to Adam, given to Noah, etc., is now given to Israel. Okay, I said Adam is God's son. If you look at Luke 4, Jesus' genealogy is always traced back all the way to Adam. It says, who was the son of Seth, who was the son of Adam, who was the son of God. Okay? Adam did not have to earn God's favor. He was already in God's favor. Okay? He was his son. What he had to do was remain faithful to his father. So now Israel's now God's son. Now Israel's God's holy nation. Now Israel has access to the tabernacle. But what comes after the tabernacle? Well, then you got to go out and you got to subdue the earth for the glory of God. All right? So the second portion of Leviticus is all about life outside the tabernacle. Okay? It's all about life the other 6 days of the week, so to speak. And at the bottom of the first page there, you have a note. It shows all sorts of comparisons about how, when God created the world, he separated things. He gave them new names. God does that throughout Scripture. He takes waters above. He separates the waters below. He calls them sky and sea and so forth. And when Jesus institutes the Lord's Supper, he takes bread. He breaks it. He says, this is my body. That's symbolic death and resurrection. You separate and then you bring back together, okay? God separates Israel from the nations. He separates them from the rest of the world. He promises to bless them, just as he did Adam and Eve. He places them in a land, which is often compared with the Garden of Eden. He gives them Sabbath rest. He promises to walk with them as their God. Okay, and you can look up those references for yourself. They're all hearkening back to promises initially made to Adam and Eve. So Israel is like God's renewed humanity through which, once again, God's original plan for humanity is going to be realized. And, of course, Israel's going to fail at that too, like everybody else, ultimately. Okay, but that's sort of the idea. And there's a little quote from Jake Sklar says at the bottom. Simply put, the Israelites are not only to be a signpost back to Eden, they are to become a manifestation of it and a people who extend Eden's borders to every corner of the earth. In other words, if you remember, when God enters into covenant with Abraham, he does it right after the Tower of Babel incident. And, you know, prior to that time, there's no Jew-Gentile distinction. There's just covenant keepers and covenant breakers. But after the Tower of Babel incident, God pulls one family out from these 70 nations of the earth, promises to make of Abraham another nation, a separate nation. He's going to give them a land, which, you know, strategically just so happens to be placed kind of in the center of the world at that time. And he says, through that people, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. In other words, God's original intention for Adam and Eve, you know, is to be realized through this people. Okay? Not only through the promised seed, which is Christ, who was an Israelite according to the flesh. Alright? But you can see how all of this is it's all harkening back to the garden. It's all like a recommissioning of humanity. And so that's why I say the first portion of Leviticus is all about drawing near to God, having access to the garden, etc. It's about the priestly task. And then when we get to the second portion, it's more about what takes place now outside of the tabernacle. So you're going to find a lot more moral legislation. Now, it will be related to the worship. It will be related to the first portion, okay, of the book, for reasons we'll see. But it's going to be more moral and ethical. And it's going to have to do more with, you know, living in the sort of the land of Eden rather than the Garden of Eden, if that makes sense. Okay, that's kind of just a little overview of what we're going to be getting our feet into, how we're getting our feet wet now. Any questions or comments there? Okay. Go. Oh, there we go. Yeah. I have to go back and look, but it doesn't say, you know, the sons of God intermarried with the daughters of men.
Right.
I think the sons of God are set. There's all sorts of debates over the Nephilim. Were they angelic beings who intermarried with humans, or were they simply the godly line? My thought is that they are the godly line. They are the set. And that's what happens is that, so now we've got this, you know, God places enmity between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. And what happens is the intermarriage that takes place between the godly line and the ungodly line, the daughters of men and the sons of God who are the set.
Ben, were you going to say something? Okay. All right. Well, let's turn over to the second page there. So in light of everything what we've said, looking at the chiastic structure and everything, we're going to see the second portion of Leviticus focuses more on the fact God wants Israel to be holy in all of life, not just from a ritual perspective, but also from a moral perspective. Okay, so we saw, for example, in Leviticus 10:10, the people were given the instruction that follows Leviticus 11 to 15 to help them distinguish between the clean and unclean so that they could know who is allowed to draw near to God and who's not. And so what we're going to see when we come into this next section, we're going to have distinctions regarding moral impurities outside of the tabernacle context, which sets up then the context of the remainder of the book, which is going to distinguish between the holy and profane. And what we mean by that is this. Remember, there are three ritual states. There's the state of holiness, and then there's the state of profane or common. And then the common is distinguished between clean and unclean. Okay? So we have all this clean and unclean distinctions in 11 to 15, which concern who may draw near to the tabernacle and who may not. And now we're going to have distinctions between holy and profane, holy and common, in the context outside the tabernacle. Okay? Roman number 3, the dramatic movement of Leviticus 17 to 27. Let me just read this. To understand the relationship of the first and second portions of Leviticus, we must grasp the fact that the newly opened access to God, granted by the sacrificial system, priesthood, and Day of Atonement, set forth in the early chapters, do not represent the goal of the covenant, but are rather collectively a means to the end of life with God. For this reason, the second half of Leviticus deals especially with the prospect of life with God, with the moral implications of what this means for a people who have the Lord dwelling in their midst. Put another way, as a consequence of the Day of Atonement, Israel is now able to participate in God's holiness, a prospect with a view to full and lasting communion with Yahweh God. Okay? God is a holy God. Israel is now going to be His holy people, separate from the nations of the world, on behalf of the nations of the world. Remember, God calls Israel, He's going to give them the land. He gives them His commandments, and He says, now you keep my commandments, I will bless you, you will prosper, and all the nations round about are going to come and inquire about me, and then you'll be able to tell them. Okay? And so that's what Israel's supposed to do. Now, we know most time in their history they don't do that very well. There is a brief period of time under Solomon where you see this kind of realized. You see Solomon seeking after the Lord. You see his wisdom. Israel becomes a prosperous nation. And the next thing we know, we have the nations all round about coming to inquire of Solomon and his wisdom. And we have an example of the Queen of Sheba coming, you know, from way down here in Africa. She comes up and she heard all this stuff about Solomon, and she gets there and she said, I hadn't heard the half of it. And here this Gentile, she blessed be Yahweh, you know, she starts speaking that way. And so you have Gentile nations round about that are being converted. And of course, again, when we get our hopes up, every time in the old covenant, they're going to be dashed. Next thing we know, you know, there's a fall again, okay, with Solomon. All right? And so, you know, things go south again for a long time. And so there's a relationship between the two, okay? In other words, God sets up the tabernacle. He dwells in the midst of Israel. Israel is allowed to draw near to Him so they can reflect His holiness to the world and be the model nation. What that means is that while this next section starts focusing more on moral concerns in the context of outside the tabernacle, it's never unrelated to the worship that's set forth in the early chapters. Okay? Let me read letter B1. Says, the transition of life beyond the boundaries of the tabernacle is already sensed in Leviticus 17, when the prohibition of sacrificing animals outside the tabernacle is prohibited. In particular, the prohibition against consuming blood is related to the blood of animals involved in the sacrificial rituals of the tabernacle. Implicit in these commands is the desire to guard Israel against idolatry. Okay? In other words, what we're going to see when you get to chapter 17 is a peculiar chapter. And there's some debate about where to put it. I'm putting it with 18 through 20 for reasons I'm going to share next time. Okay? There's a phrase we're going to see that's going to run from chapter 17 through chapter 18, etc. But when we come to chapters 18 to 20, we're going to see that the legislation is more ethical in nature, and it has to do with the holiness of Israel as a nation. Okay? And the point I want to see is this. In the Bible, we're told again and again that people become like who they worship. Okay? Man is first and foremost, some of the church will call us a homo adorans, looking at adoration, man and worshiper, some say homo liturgicus. Okay? Man is a worshiping creature. You never go from worshiping God to not worshiping. You're always worshiping something. You worship God, you're eating His table, or you're eating the table of Jesus. Okay? So God sets up this tabernacle. He invites Israel to His presence. And they are to worship Him. They are in the process of worshiping Him, become holy themselves, and then go out from there and be holy to the nations, be a model to the nations. Okay? Think about this. In Psalm 115, the psalmist describes idols and how they are deaf, they're blind. They don't hear, they don't speak, they don't see. They're made of stone, things like that. And the psalmist says, so are all those who worship. Okay? So are all those who worship. Now, the prophet Isaiah comes later and he builds on this. Oftentimes, when he is conducting his ministry to the nation of Israel, and he pronounces judgment on the nation. You know, Isaiah had a really peculiar task. God calls him. God says, I need somebody to go preach to these people. And Isaiah is like, he volunteers. You know, here I am. Okay? He's enthusiastic, idealistic, right? God tells him, he says, okay, Isaiah, you go and you preach. And by the way, they're not going to listen to you. Okay? But you preach anyway. Because you'll harden these people. Okay? So don't you worry about the response. You just preach. Okay? And through your preaching, you're going to harden these people. So that seeing they won't see, hearing they won't hear, etc. When you come to the New Testament, Jesus quotes Isaiah in the context of speaking in parables to the crowds of Israel. Okay? Mark chapter 4. Jesus there's a big block of parables. Let me just go there while we're here. And Jesus speaks in parables. And Mark says, verse 2, then he taught them many things by parables and said to them in his teaching. And he goes on and gives this parable. And then in verse 9 he says, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. Then verse 10 says, but when he was alone, those around him with the 12 asked him about the parable. And he said to them, to you it has been given to know the mystery of the kingdom of God. But to those who are outside, all things come in parables, so that, here's the quote from Isaiah's commission, seeing they may see and not perceive, and hearing they may hear and not understand, lest they should turn and their sins be forgiven them. Okay? So, Jesus is speaking in parables. Now, why is he speaking in parables? He used to say, well, Jesus created these little memorable stories, you know, with these life lessons that, you know, he put his flesh on so that people could learn. That's not the reason Jesus spoke in parables. Jesus spoke in parables so that people would not understand. Okay? He spoke that way to the crowd so that they would not understand. Parables, as Isaiah explains later, are a sign of judgment. God speaking in parables, that means you're being judged. Okay? Now, so Jesus speaks to the crowds in parables so that they will not understand. Okay? At the end of this chapter, verse 33, it says, and with many such parables he spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it. But without a parable, he did not speak to them. And when they were alone, he explained all things to his disciples. So he's speaking to the crowd. You've got to know that out of the crowd, there are going to be Pharisees, there are going to be people distracted. They're not there because they're interested in hearing what Jesus had to say to them because there's a crowd. Or they're trying to trick Jesus up on something. So Jesus is speaking to the crowd so that parables so that they will not understand. But when he's alone with the disciples, he explains things to them. He speaks more clearly. Now, at the end of Jesus' ministry, he kind of takes the gloves off and his parables become real, real straightforward. So, like, when he gives the parable of the wicked vine dresser, the Jews, like, they perceive he's talking about us. Okay? Well, here's the thing. So, what has happened is Israel has become like the gods they serve. You worship idols. Now, Israel's not engaging in Molech and Baal and so forth, but they're worshiping a state. We have no king but Caesar. We could spend some time making an application there, couldn't we? Okay? And so what? They become like the idols they serve. They become deaf, they become blind. It's a lex talionis, it's an eye for eye, tooth for tooth judgment. You don't want to worship me. Worship these dumb idols and become like them. Okay? What a commentary on our culture today. Yeah. Fortunately, life has been way too busy for Facebook lately. You know, I glance at it if I'm somewhere and I've got a few minutes. But my goodness, you'll go crazy very quickly. I mean, you look at the articles and the stuff and, you know, the news headlines and we're like, we've taken stupid pills, you know? God's judging us, okay? He's judging our nation. He's sending us, a strong illusion that we should believe a lie. Okay? God says, you don't hear my word, fine. You're going to be judged accordingly. I'll take it from you. I'll give it to somebody else. And I'm going to make you stupid. Okay? That's what Romans 1 teaches. You know, sin makes you stupid, basically. All right? And so you become like what you worship. That's my whole point in kind of diverging here. Well, in the same way, Israel's supposed to become like the God they worship. And so God gives them access to Him in the first portion of the book so they can draw near to Him. Kind of be like Moses up there on the mountain, you know, and they come down from the mountain kind of lowly, so to speak. Well, that seems to be the idea here. We come to the second section now. We come down from the holy mountain. And that's what we do every week, right? We go up, start supporting, we hear the law being read. And then we come down the mountain. Hopefully we're transfigured. People may not see us going. You know? But like that, hopefully that's
I think exactly. You know, how we're going to relate to each other is dependent on how we relate to God. So, you know, there's the Godward dimension, no other gods before me, etc. You know, no graven images, don't take the Lord's name in vain, and so on. Those are all. Love God, all your heart, soul, mind, strength. And then the second table of the law, don't kill your neighbor, don't commit adultery with your wife, don't covet his stuff, don't bear false witness against him. Love your neighbor as yourself. But the second half flows from the first half. Exactly. Yes, ma'am.
I'm trying to get a sense of Israel's calling. Were they called to be holy, the nations would come to them, or were they called to be holy and go out, or both?
I think more in the Old Covenant, there's a static nature of grace. I think the nation of God strategically put Israel in the center of the world. So they were there, but they were a bridge between three continents on the eastern edge of the Mediterranean. So if you're going from Europe over to Asia, you usually go by boat, you can get off of Israel. Or if you're going from Europe down to Africa, you're going to go through Israel. And so I think God was bringing the nation to Israel more so because of the static nature of grace as compared to now, whereas the gospel goes out and flows out across the cross, we've been given more ethical power because of the Holy Spirit. But Jesus says, wait in Jerusalem for power to come out. And then you'll be witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the ends of the earth. Okay?
I do think there is a really neglected means of evangelism today in that we don't understand this idea of being a holy nation and being a model for others. You know, most evangelism today is just cold calling. You know, we're trying to sell people on things they don't want. And why should they? Because they see Christians and what's their delight? Company included, how many ways, you know, how worldly are we? You know, how worldly are we and we don't even realize it? All right, let's go to the last page there. Are we going to do a chant there? We're going to practice one? Okay. All right. So I'm hoping you see kind of a connection first and second portion of the book. God allowing Israel to worship Him. So the early legislation is cultic in nature. That means worship related. Okay? Because culture flows out of the cultus. Okay? The God you worship determines the kind of culture you're going to produce. Alright. So, think about this. Within the nation of Israel, most Israelites were just common. They were clean. That was their ordinary state. In relation to the ordinary Israelites were the priests who were holy to the Lord. And the high priest was, you know, even more holy. That's why the legislation, we're going to see the legislation concerning him, is more strict than it is for just the priest. And the legislation of the priest is even more strict than that for the Israelites. Okay? And so there's degrees of holiness. So in relationship to the priest, the average Israelite was not holy. He was just common. But in relation to the Gentiles, Israel as a nation was holy. And, you know, the passage there, Exodus 19:6, is, you know, the classic one. And Peter quotes this of the church and applies it to the church in the New Covenant. You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Notice the connection between the kingdom and priesthood, okay? They're the priests. They get access to the sanctuary. Then they got the kingly task of through them all nations blessed. Okay, you should be me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So in comparison with the Gentiles, Israel as a whole is holy. All right. With that in mind, what you'll find, and this is kind of, I think, the key to unlocking this next section that distinguishes between holy and profane, is that the legislation that is given in Leviticus, particularly 18 through 20, again, we're going to look at 17. We're going to come back to that because it has a real bearing on the new covenant. But the legislation in chapters 18 through 20 is bracketed by the command to be separate from the nations. Okay? What I mean is this. We have to remember the context. Okay? Why, you know, God gives the Ten Commandments and He gives these case laws and later on He gives a bunch of other laws in Deuteronomy and so forth. Deuteronomy means second law, of course. Why the legislation that we're given here in Leviticus 18 through 20? Now we get in all these moral stipulations. Okay?
This section is bracketed by references either to Egypt or Canaan. Okay? Israel has just left Egypt. Israel has been worshiping the gods of Egypt. Again, Joshua makes that clear. When you're just reading Exodus 1, you think bad things happen, a new Pharaoh emerges, and just make things tough, and Israel calls out. No, Joshua makes it clear Israel had been worshiping the gods of Egypt, which is why God raised up Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or whoever, you know, to judge the nation, right? Okay? And so, one of the purposes of the plagues was to show who was God, not just to the Egyptians, but also to Israel. See, all those plagues, they weren't just random displays of power. The Egyptians had a god for the Nile, they had a god for the sun, they had a god for the locusts, etc. So God is humiliating the gods of Egypt. And just like the God humiliated the prophets of Baal with Elijah on Mount Carmel. Who's really God? What did the Egyptians need to find that out? It was Israel need to find it out too. And so we know how the Israelites worked. When they got out into the wilderness, how they wanted to go back to Egypt and everything. They didn't go to the mountains. After everything, the plagues, the Red Sea, everything, and yet, you know, they fall back into sin that quickly. They had been worshiping the gods of Egypt. And so you find in this legislation warnings about being separate from Egypt and or Canaan, the people whose land they dwelt. They were going to be soon inhabiting, or were supposed to soon be inhabiting. In Roman number 4, letter A1, says, note how the parallel prohibitions of chapter 18 and 20 that bracket the ethical stipulations begin and end with prohibitions against Israel following in the statutes of the nations. Okay? According to the doings of the land of Egypt where you dwell, you shall not do. And according to the doings of the land of Canaan where I'm bringing you, you shall not do, nor shall you walk in their ordinances. Okay? That's the preface to the ethical stipulations that follow. And of course then, you know, this kind of stuff is repeated again in chapter 20 near the end. Israel's now God's holy nation. You cannot be like those Egyptians. You cannot be like the Canaanites in whose land you're going to dwell. Okay? And so those, the particular prohibitions that we see here are all about making Israel separate from the nations. Let me quote Mary Douglas here. Mary Douglas is a cultural anthropologist who did all sorts of work on Leviticus. And she says this, the contrast with Deuteronomy 27 shows that the anathemas in Leviticus 18 and 20 are not about everyday affairs. They say nothing about marriage, inheritance, divorce, or choice of marriage partners. They are not concerned with wrong conduct in family life so much as with breach of covenant. These are laws about faithfully worshiping the only Lord God and about defilement by idolatry. The verses start with Egypt and Canaan, referring with loathing to Egyptian and Canaanite cults. Both supporting chapters mention Molech worship. The second one denounces mediums and seers. The pure and noble character of the Hebrew God is contrasted with the libidinous customs of the false gods. That's a new word for me. I had to Google that one. But it has to do with strong sexual desire. So what you find in 1820, this little kind of structure here, is there's a lot of prohibitions that have to do with sexual immorality and idolatry. The two go together, especially in the ancient world. Okay? Baal, as we know, Baal was a storm god. Okay? And Israel was an agricultural community. And Baal was the female god, and Baal was the male god, Asherah was the female god. And so a lot of Baal worship, part of the appeal to it was very sexual in nature. The Israelites would engage in intercourse as a way to get Baal and Asherah to have intercourse, make it rain, produce fertility, produce crops. Okay? And you think about Israel at the golden calf worship, what did they do? You know, they worship the golden calf and they engage in sexual immorality. Okay? So, you know, to my point, these laws are not random. Okay? These laws are there's allusions made to all Ten Commandments in chapter 19. Okay? So, in these two chapters, they kind of frame, you know, chapter 19. Let me just conclude here. Not surprisingly, letter C, the second section of Leviticus repeatedly expresses the need for holiness. Be holy, for I am holy. Okay? However, it'd be wrong to assume a sharp distinction between cultic and ethical requirements. Besides, many moral concerns were also causes of uncleanness, thereby polluting the fender, sanctuary, and land. In short, ritual purity and ethical conduct were mutual obligations with a reciprocal relationship, since the purpose of tabernacle worship was to sanctify Israel in the first place. Put differently, the goal and consequence of chapters 1 to 16 is the sanctification of Israel set forth in chapters 17 to 27. God grants Israel access to Him. They can worship Him. They can become like Him. They can be a holy people who will be a model for the nations. That's the goal. And that's why the first section focuses on public issues, but the second section more about moral issues. And here again, this is, you know, this is teaching us again. What's wrong with the culture out there? It's us. It's the church. So the church needs to act in order. We can pull balance on you one. You can campaign, whatever. Until the salt sauce is sacred, that's what happens. The church got to get this act in order. That's our priority. Because the culture flows out of us. Does that make sense? That's a lot of stuff. That's kind of abstract and stuff.
Hard time coming to grips with this, but I hope some of that makes some sense today. Any questions? Yes, sir.
It seems like what we're reading here is part of what the Greek culture was like when Paul was preaching, sharing the gospel. That's the Greek culture right there. For the gospel, part of being part of the gospel of who Jesus was.
Exactly. We're going to rest in our study of Corinthians, and this is talking about many things, a lot of the issues there. Paul's going to refer back to these clean and clean things. He's going to appeal to Leviticus in his arguments, with the Corinthians. Isn't it interesting to also think about this? How often the New Testament warns against idolatry?
When you don't read about anybody bowing to idols in the New Testament. I mean, you know, the captivity kind of cured Israel of Baal worship and stuff, but idolatry of sorts still went on. It's kind of interesting. 1 John, the book ends, little children, keep yourselves from idols. Amen. And he hadn't talked about idolatry in this book hardly. Okay? But idolatry can take on different forms.